We head to the G&M Family Market phone line to welcome in one of our absolute favorite guests. He is the author of two fantastic books on baseball and music, Big Hair and Plastic Grass, and Stars and Strikes, looking back at the bicentennial baseball year of 1976. He writes for any publication that's worth reading, and if somebody is smart, they'll hire him to a full-time gig because he's one of the most talented writers there is. And one of our favorite guests on the show, Dan Epstein, welcome on back to Downtown.
Hey, thanks. It's great to be back, and thanks for the prop.
Hey, absolutely. Well, a great piece, Rolling Stone, rollingstone.com, well, about this guy here and this very album. Madman, drummers, bombers, and Indians in the summer with a teenage diplomat. 45 years ago, that is how Bruce Springsteen made his entry into the music world with his first album, Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey. And that one's held up pretty well for 45 years.
It really has. You know, it's funny. It's a record that I've loved since I first discovered it, which was probably around 1980 or so, like coming off... I think I bought The River, and which was the first Springsteen record that, you know, I bought in real time, and went back and wanted to check out his earlier stuff, and it always kind of stuck out as an oddball item in the Springsteen catalog, because of course this is pre E Street Band, although there were some guys on the record who would later become members in good standing of the E Street Band. But it's kind of a jumble of singer-songwriter type songs like Mary Queen of Arkansas and The Angel, and then more really kind of ones like Blinded by the Light, like you were just playing, that kind of pointed more in the direction he would go with the Wild, the Innocent, the E Street Shuffle. And then, some more kind of ones that were kind of somewhere in between, things like Growing Up and For You, It's Hard to Be a Saint in the City, all of which had a little bit of Van Morrison, Bob Dylan influence, but were also clearly, he had clearly found his voice already.
I love the description that you include in the piece. Lester Bangs, the great Rolling Stone critic, talking about Springsteen and described him as... sort of like Robbie Robertson on Quaaludes with Dylan barfing down the back of his neck.
Yeah, if you could, pretty much the only person who is more verbose than Springsteen in this period was Lester Bangs. So I think it's kind of beautiful that he wound up reviewing this album. But it was interesting to me going back and looking at that review. That Greetings from Asbury Park came out in January of 1973. That review didn't run in Rolling Stone until almost 6 months later, which I think, a Springsteen record now, of course, would get a review in Rolling Stone, the minute the promos hit the desk. But back then, he clearly was not on the mainstream music media's radar.
You point out, too, and I thought this was very interesting, this was his first album, but he had been making music for a while before this, and this album was very different because of the lyrical nature than his previous work had been.
Yeah, his band, he'd actually been in a band before this called Steel Mill, which was, there are a few tracks of theirs that are out there legally that you can listen to, and they're kind of hard rock, they're more kind of jam-oriented, they're not... I would say if they're probably closer in content and spirit to something like Humble Pie than to anything on Greetings from Asbury Park. And I think what had happened, and Bruce talks about this a bit in his autobiography, Born to Run, was that, he'd been playing in bands for years up to this point and really had not had much success. And Steel Mill was only kind of a regional success in New Jersey, but they, never got a recording deal or anything. And he kind of figured that his best way, really his only option at this point, was to go the singer-songwriter route. And he had a lot of words in his head that he wanted to get out on paper. And so when he auditioned for CBS Records, it was as this kind of acoustic troubadour with a ton of words at his disposal. And they really saw him as kind of this new Dylan figure. And of course, back in the early 70s, everybody was looking for a new Dylan. And but between the time that he was signed to CBS and when he started making the record, it, you know, I think he realized that that was not what he wanted to be completely seen as. And he wanted to get other musicians on the record. He didn't want it to be an all, you know, all acoustic and voice type of record.
And he got the deal with Columbia on the strength of the song that ended up being the final track on the album.
Right. It's Hard to Be a Saint in the City, which is probably my favorite song off the record. But when he played it for John Hammond in his office, it was just on an acoustic guitar. And it's really, you know, with more of a full band arrangement on the record, which really kind of gives it a more evocative feel as far as I'm concerned. And then, you know, if you listen to bootlegs, Springsteen bootlegs from the 70s when he was playing with the E Street Band and Miami Steve was in the band by this point, that song would really get sort of drawn out into a long guitar jam with him trading licks. That was quite dramatic and cool. But I really like the way it ends, Greetings from Asbury Park.
Now, even though this was his first album, he asserted a little bit of independence in the title of the album because he wanted to distinguish himself as being somebody from New Jersey and not someplace else.
Yeah, his Jersey roots were really important to him. I mean, that really was his life, was, you know, growing up in Freehold in Asbury Park, New Jersey. But when he signed with Columbia, they really wanted to market him as a New York artist. And I think some of that was because in a lot of these songs that made it onto this record, there are references to New York City. There are, you know, images that, you know, make you think of early 70s Big Apple. But, and I think some of it too was that, you know, as part of the new Dylan concept, you know, it would hold more weight if he was from New York as opposed to New Jersey. But he, you know, he insisted that, you know, they had to be honest about where he was coming from, you know, literally and figuratively. And, you know, if you think back to the early 70s, it was pretty rare for an artist, especially, you know, a solo artist, to not have their photo on the cover of their debut album. So for him to lead with an album that's basically this old-fashioned postcard of Asbury Park, that was actually pretty radical for the time.
We're talking with Dan Epstein here on Downtown. Was it, I'm trying to remember the chronology here, was it before or after the release of Greetings from Asbury Park that John Lando famously said, I've seen the future of rock and roll, and his name is Bruce Springsteen?
Oh, that was after. I think that was about 2 years after, in fact. That was after Wild Innocent A Street Shuffle came out, but before Born to Run.
Interesting, too, the producers of this first album and their connection, not one people would expect, to the Partridge Family.
Yeah, that's Springsteen's first manager, a guy named Mike Appel, was actually, he'd been in the music business since the mid-60s. He had played guitar and written songs for various one-off, you know, kind of one-hit wonders like Magicians, who had a song called Invitation to Cry, and The Balloon Farm, who had a kind of psychedelic hit called The Question of Temperature. But by the time he got around to, you know, when he hooked up with Springsteen, he was best known in the music business for having written songs for the Partridge Family, along with his partner, a guy named Jim Kritikos. And they had, actually, the Partridge Family had one very big hit with a song called Doesn't Anybody Want to Be Wanted that Kritikos and Appel had written. So it's interesting that, you know, Springsteen, who's a person we think of as, you know, an artist of, you know, impeccable credibility, at the time, the Partridge Family, I mean, though they're quite loved today in a kind of nostalgic way, at the time, the Partridge Family were the antithesis of credibility. They were this, you know, manufactured-for-TV bubblegum group, but here is one of their songwriters managing this hot young singer-songwriter named Bruce Springsteen.
Now, if I remember right, wasn't it Mike Appel that he ended up in a lawsuit with that kept him from recording for a couple of years?
Yeah, the big break between Born to Run and Darkness on the Edge of Town was due to that lawsuit. I think, you know, what had happened was that Springsteen, like most you know, so many artists who are starting out in the business signed a management deal with Appel that, you know, grossly favored the manager. But at the time, it was sort of a choice between, do I sign this contract with this guy or do I keep kind of, you know, trying this on my own and butting my head against the wall, whereas here's this guy who can help me out. And I think that that's a conundrum a lot of artists still face to this day. And in Springsteen's autobiography, he talks about, you know, really like what a raw deal it was. But at the same time, he has a lot of gratitude and love for Mike Appel, because if it hadn't been for Appel, he wouldn't have got him that audition with John Hammond at Columbia.
You point out in your Rolling Stone piece that two of the best-known songs from the album and two that are still performed a lot in concert, Blinded by the Light and Spirit in the Night, almost didn't even make it in.
Yeah, they were not on the original running order. He actually hadn't even written them by the time that he and Appel handed in the you know, what they thought was the finished version of Greetings from Asbury Park to Clive Davis at Columbia. And at the time, at that point in the making of the record, it had been split 50-50 into songs with a band and acoustic songs. And what happened was they handed it to Clive, and Clive said, you know, I don't hear a single on this. So he kicked it back to them, and Springsteen, from the sound of it, like in a matter of a week, wrote both Blinded by the Light and Spirit in the Night. And they kicked off three of the acoustic songs that had been recorded to make room for those two songs. And they really, you know, I mean, I think not only are those two of the strongest songs on the record, but they really pointed the direction that he was going in as an artist, more kind of, you know, more R&B influenced, more kind of experimental musically. And, you know, you can really draw a direct line from those songs to The Wild, the Innocent, and the E Street Shuffle, which is my personal favorite Springsteen record, which actually came out only about 9 months later.
My Springsteen story is one I'd sort of forgotten about, and I was reminded of it indirectly through you. You had posted a picture of some vinyl. You were listening to a lot of 45s, and I got myself a brand new turntable and went back and got into my old albums. And I found a bunch of Springsteen albums, and the story is back in 85, I was working at a country radio station doing mornings and programming the music, and we started playing I'm on Fire and My Hometown, and we were a reporting station to Radio and Records and Billboard in those days,
sure.
And they ended up doing an article on us playing Springsteen on a country station in Billboard. A few weeks later, I get a box in the mail. And there's a letter in it from John Landau. Saw the story
wow.
in Billboard, and just want to thank you for your support of Bruce's music. Here's a little token of our appreciation. And it was every Springsteen album that had been recorded up to that time, autographed by Bruce.
Wow, do you still have them?
I do, and I found them the other night when I had
That's
to road cool. test that brand new turntable. So thanks to you.
Oh man, that's I'm glad you've reacquainted yourself with that stash. That sounds pretty amazing.
Absolutely. So here we are, 45 years later. Obviously, Springsteen has fulfilled the promise of that first album, but has he ever captured? Could he ever capture the feeling that people had when they heard that sound for the first time in '73?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's really a moment in time that's kind of magically captured by this record. And you know, and I don't know that he could recapture it. I don't know that he'd want to. I think it's very, it's very much honest. It's very much him. It's very much him at, you know, age 23, you know, living in some dumpy apartment, you know, down by the Asbury Park boardwalk, and, you know, living on, you know, his accumulated change. And, you know, it's really a remarkable record to me, because it really does kind of, it perfectly illustrates him right before. I mean, he doesn't really take off with the next record. His build really was actually kind of gradual when you think about it, but he really does kind of take off artistically on the next record. And, And each record after this would be very different from the one that came before it.
And he survived immediate fame. It wasn't immediate for him because he'd been going at it for years. But when he ended up on the cover of Time and Newsweek simultaneously, and there was always a blowback to that kind of thing. And he continued to make good music. But to me, he's made some great music and some of his best music when he stopped caring about fame into the 90s and in this century.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, probably my least favorite Springsteen record is Born in the USA. And, you know, some of that has to do with the 80s production values on it. And some of it has to do with just, you know, I heard all those songs a million times in 84 and 85 and really don't need to hear them again. But I feel like that was the one record that he made where he was just really going for it and thinking about, like, taking it, you know, how do we take this to the next level commercially? And I think he, you know, if you read his book, I think he has a lot of regrets about that and where, you know, where that led him. And I think, you know, so many of the records he made after that were a, you know, kind of almost a violent reaction to what that had experience had been like for him.
Well, make sure you read this wonderful piece from Dan at RollingStone.com. I also wanted to mention, too, you had it out on social media today. Sad news with the passing of Fast Eddie Clarke of Motorhead.
Yeah, the guitarist of the classic lineup of Motorhead is now gone, and that means that the entire classic lineup of Motorhead is no longer with us. Filthy Animal Taylor died in late 2015. Lemmy died not much longer after that, and now Fast Eddie. So it's awful sad, and I think he was only 67. I mean, it's really. But you know, those guys packed a lot of living into their time on Earth and a lot of great music. So I'm very thankful that they were here with us.
Dan Epstein, always fun for us to talk with you. Thanks so much for making time for us this afternoon.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rich. Always a pleasure.
We'll talk to you again soon. 22 minutes after the hour here.